in life. When one has said all that, of course one does return to the actual accomplishment of the Heartbreak House, and I would have thought perhaps Heartbreak House above all. Extraordinary work, which, if one to believe Shaw, had been conceived as early as 1916, and which does give and explores intellectually that image of the broken values more clearly and distinctly, perhaps, than anything except Eliot in his early work does in the whole of this period. Now, as I said at the beginning of this lecture, I do feel that it is a certain impertinence to try and deal with such a wide period in a single lecture, and I can only promise you that I don't intend to try and rectify that by extending the discourse beyond the normal and allotted period. And I would like to conclude by choosing rather arbitrarily two names for comment. I have said nothing as yet of the younger poets who gained a considerable reputation in England, and not only in England, in the 30s. Mr. Auden, Mr. Spender, Mr. Day Lewis, and Mr. McNeice. I find a certain sense of hesitation in trying to evaluate their work. One grows older and one finds that one is unable fully to have that sort of impact from the work of younger writers that one had once from a generation that was contemporary with one's own. I always recall Mr. Yeats's remark when he was making his anthology of modern verse: I was wrong about Joyce, I mustn't be wrong now about the younger poets. Well, the result was that Joyce put in a great deal of very dubious merit into his anthology of modern verse. And when I say that I hesitate, it's not entirely from any desire not to be unjust. It's also from a desire not to be sentimental. I would only say of this group that I think probably, on the whole, they had not the same originality of thought that they felt they had. That their political and social thinking followed perhaps more traditional lines than they themselves believed. Having said that, I would like to give it as my own opinion that Auden, although so frequently his thought is crude, had an ear for English verse, and particularly an ear for the transference of the more conversational elements of English verse into poetry. That was remarkable. He belonged, as indeed did the whole of this group, to a school that wished to remove everything that was romantic from English poetry, to deny what has been one of the most long and valuable traditions in our verse. I read recently a review in England written by one who belonged to this same school of the collected works of Mr. G.K. Chesterton. And the comment was, why should one worry to collect the works of Mr. G.K. Chesterton? After all, William Morris did this sort of thing much better, and nobody worries about William Morris. Well, if you have reached that stage of removing out of the whole range of accept everything that is romantic, you are going to destroy one of the most permanent traditions, I think, in our literature. Having said that, perhaps I may be allowed here at the end to be for a moment reminiscent. And reminiscent in an attempt to do justice to this younger school. I recall in 1939, a few weeks after the war had begun, that I lectured in Oxford to a large group of students who had been drawn from all various countries in Europe, at a time when one could still draw students from all countries in Europe. And the conclusion of my lecture had been to try and persuade this very varied group of young students that W.B. Yeats was a greater poet than Mr. Orton. And I had, and perhaps unfairly, quoted from Orton the two lines, "Here am I, here are you, what does it mean, and what are we going to do?" And I had put against that what seemed to me one of the bravest and most handsome of those later and severe poems of Yeats. Well, I had to go to London during the day, and when I came back at night, I found that the quadrangle was full of these young people, and that they were all singing to each other. And what they were singing was, "Here am I, and here are you, and what does it mean, and what are we going to do?" And I realized, of course, that the two lines had for them a sort of practical relevance, which I had not realized when I first read them. But it also made me realize that Orton had a sort of immediate, perhaps even a symbolical relationship to his own generation, something into which one could only enter if one belonged to that particular generation. And one has to discover, one will have to discover, whether out of that there is going to be something which is of more permanent importance. I would only add as a final comment there that I feel that whole group of younger writers wrote at their best when they were writing about the Republican War in Spain. Whatever one may think of that war politically, poetically, it was something that called upon the best poetic attainment of a whole group of young writers. Well, I have mentioned Yeats in connection with Orton, and I would like in conclusion here to say this single word about Yeats, that it does seem to me that Yeats solves the problem of the creative writer in this period in a way in which none of the other names that I have mentioned have been able to do. For Yeats does move from his early melodious romantic work to that beautiful but severe work of the later period without any sense of distress, or without any distress that becomes creatively troublesome. And he has moved through the whole of the Irish Troubles of 1916 and yet kept something that is a faith, something that is complete and integrated in his mind. And unlike Huxley and Eliot and the others, the completion of that faith does not lessen the power of his poetry or of his creative achievement. It's a little difficult to know how it is won. At Oxford, he wrote on one occasion, "I went constantly to All Souls Chapel, though never at service time. In Dublin, I went to St. Patrick and sat there, but it was far off. That is my tradition, and I will let no priest rob me of it. I am very religious." and deprived by Huxley and Tyndall, whom I detested, of the simple-minded religion of my childhood. I had made a new religion, almost an infallible church out of poetic tradition, a fardel of stories, of personages, and of emotions, inseparable from their first expression, passed on from generation to generation by poets and painters, with some help from philosophers and theologians. I wished for a world where I could discover this tradition perpetually, not in pictures and poems only, but in tiles round the chimneypiece and in hangings that keep out the draught. I had even created a dogma, because those imaginary people are created out of the deepest instinct of man to be his measure and norm. Whatever I can imagine those mouths speaking must be the nearest I can go to truth. And on that, and somehow at the basis of all that, the later poems came. Well, a fardel of stories, of personages and of emotion, may be very little to rescue out of the poet, period. But I think in point of fact, one is rescuing more than that. One is rescuing a certain faith in the continuity of the creative imagination. Thank you.